Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way. It's the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies, but not in a creepy way.
Spoiler alert.
Remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder treason and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Welcome, this is Eric.
And this is Brother Jay.
Welcome to episode 50 of Not in a Creepy Way. Thank you, Brother Jay, for helping me get this far into episode 50. Can you believe it?
I did not realize it was episode 50.
Yes, that's why we're doing this at this time. That's why, by the way, I had 4 movies for Halloween, not 3, not 5. But I want V for Vendetta to be freaking episode 50.
Because it's a 5?
Exactly.
Okay. I'll give you credit for that.
No. And of course, this could have been episode 5 of the podcast, but that wasn't going to work out. We actually shoehorned in 2 movies into episode 14 just to get the 007s in there.
That's true.
Yeah. And that turns, in retrospect, that was a crazy move, but fun, but crazy. Although it does allow me to say that we've had 50 episodes and 50 movies, because we have 1 episode with no movies, and we have 1 episode with 2 movies. Actually, no, we have 2 episodes with 2 movies, because Creepshow 1 and 2.
Did we have an episode with no movies?
Jason's List of Judgment. I mean, we talk about movies throughout the episode, but there was no one movie.
There was no singular movie.
Exactly. Okay. Yes. Episode 2 has no movie. Actually, episode 1 has a TV movie. So actually, we are up to 50 movies. Theatrical releases, at least.
Yeah, because the Electric Grandmother, yeah,
a TV movie. So anyway.
That's not even counting the podcast that wasn't.
Oh, exactly, yeah. Which, as it turns out, that was a fun thing, because that podcast was not sustainable. I think narrowing it down was much needed.
No, it was a good first run.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, anyway. It was great, yeah. It allowed us to show each other that we had chemistry, so that worked out well. So, although there's no evidence of the chemistry because it was never recorded. Anyway, and if you realize that episode of Electric Grandmother is like, what, not even 30 minutes long, which is a little bit crazy. Tonight we're going to talk about the movie V for Vendetta, directed by James McTeague, and written by the Wachowskis, based on the graphic novel by Alan Moore and David Lloyd. Now, what year was this movie put out? Because that's the one thing I didn't put on my notes.
2005.
2005, okay. So,
however, it was conceived and kicked around before the Wachowski brothers were working on The Matrix. Some of what they wanted to do was in concept before The Matrix, which was 99. The movie was made until 2005.
Director James McTeague, he actually doesn't have a lot of directing credits. He is more of an AD or a second unit director, because he's been second unit or assistant director on all the Matrix movies, Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, Dark City, Paradise Road, The Raven, and Speed Racer. The Wachowskis directed Bound, which actually is a pretty great movie. We'll need to talk about that at some time. And the Matrix movies, of course, and then Speed Racer and Cloud Atlas.
They made a Speed Racer movie?
Yeah, with Christina Ricci and who's the guy? I can't remember.
Isn't one of the Wachowski brothers now a woman?
Yes, they used to be in this movie. When they put V for Vendetta, they're credited as Andy and Larry, but now it's Andy and Lana.
Okay.
Either way, good for him. Or her. Good for them.
Yeah, no, I don't care. It was one of those the minutia trivia that was in my head.
Yeah. Well, it's worthy of note. And then, how familiar are you with the graphic novel itself?
I'm not.
Okay, that's probably a good thing. I'm not an expert in it.
I shouldn't say I'm not familiar with it. I have bits and pieces of the graphic novel from looking at it online, but I haven't read the whole graphic novel, because it's more than just one. It's a series, isn't it?
Well, it's like, I think it was a 12 issue or a 15 issue series that was bound into a graphic novel.
Yeah. So, I haven't. I really want to, but part of me really wants to, and part of me doesn't want to, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, oh, I saw the movie. Now I'm going to read the book, except that sometimes that ends very badly.
Yeah.
There, you can't ever go back and watch the movie again.
I think you can. If you started it with the movie, I think it's fine, especially this movie, because this movie is so well done. They changed some things. You know, the book itself was more like an anti-Thatcher book about like fascism versus anarchy. And Alan Moore specifically said that what was done in the movie was they basically took all of the good anarchy bits out of it. But, you know, it's, you know, this movie is, it's more of a 1984 kind of thing. Although a lot of that was from the graphic novel too. And it's interesting that David Lloyd, the artist, he came up with the whole Guy Fawkes idea. When they're trying to do the story itself, Alan Moore's telling him about the story, and he goes, well, why don't we give him the Guy Fawkes mask and that whole persona? And then he created a mask that is slightly different than the traditional mask, but we're, of course, very familiar with it now because it's all over this movie, and now you'll never get a Guy Fawkes mask that doesn't look like V for Vendetta.
Well, and also because I think Anonymous uses it as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, that's part of the point. I mean, that's the one thing I thought was very brave about putting this out in 2005 is that it was after 2001. It's hard to have a pro-terrorist movie, you know?
Well, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's back to the good old days of, you know, because the Star Wars movies, you know, the government were the bad guys in those movies. So how did this movie enter your consciousness or enter? Why is this one of your favorite movies?
I'm trying to recall. Maybe I saw it in the theaters 2005. I'm trying to think. Go back in time in 2005 where I was.
Well, it had, you know, it's a movie with Natalie Portman in it, so that already sells it a little bit.
Yeah, because I'm a huge Natalie Portman fan, Star Wars notwithstanding. Because I like her. I think she's hilarious, and I also have a lot of respect for her because, you know, she's hugely educated and smart and has a career and takes herself seriously outside of Hollywood and doesn't take Hollywood very seriously. And in fact, didn't show up to her award because she was busy studying for her and cramming for her finals, which again, that's not a common trait of most current actors. But I as an actress, I don't know that her career calling was acting, and her future may not be, but you know, just this was hilarious. She had some funny parts, but it was a very serious movie as opposed to like her Saturday Night Live performance, which was hilarious, and her digital short, which is actually on my version of the DVD, which is also one of my most favorite Natalie Portman things ever.
Well, and it's Anastasia is going to criticize us if she listens to this because I'm going to mention her hair, but it's kind of an important thing. She actually shaved her head for this role.
Yeah.
And it was important to do so because it's an important part of the story.
It's an integral part of the story.
Yeah.
Why would Anastasia not dig that?
Oh, no, because she'll assume we're being sexist.
Well, I think, it's as much a plot point as you never see Hugo Weaving's face.
Oh, but you do. Well, no, you're right. You don't see V's face ever.
Right. You actually see Hugo Weaving at one point.
Yeah.
You actually can see his face in one point of the movie. As Hugo Weaving, you can see him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, we'll talk about that. That makes the movie beautiful. Yeah. I interrupted how this movie came to you and why we're talking about it.
I'm guessing I saw it in the theater because 2005 would have been about the right time. I must have seen it in the movie theaters.
Well, I've got a test for you if you saw it in the theaters. One of the things about this movie, about seeing it in a theater, which is very powerful. I mean, the whole movie, because it's visually very stunning, is great in a theater and great even on a big screen TV, whatever. But the end, when they roll the end credits and you have the Stones' Street Fighting Man.
Yeah.
Along with the end credits. I mean, that's a beautiful credit sequence.
It is.
And, you know, in a theater setting, that'll pump you up. You'll drive home a little faster because of that.
Well, and also because it's kind of a montage of the music.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then, yeah, it's got that political song right after that with all the political speeches in there. And then you have, the 1812 Overture at the very end, if I remember correctly.
Right. Yeah.
But the Street Fighting Man is really powerful when they show the credits because of the drums and everything. Anyway, so we want to dive into the plot itself.
Yeah.
The movie opens with the voiceover of Evie's story of Guy Fawkes and the gunpowder plot. And then we have a television program with the voice of London, Lewis Prothero, played by Roger Allam.
So, I read that the former United States is so desperate for medical supplies that they have allegedly sent several containers filled with wheat and tobacco. A gesture, they said, of goodwill. You want to know what I think? Well, you're listening to my show, so I will assume you do. I think it's high time we let the colonies know what we really think of them. I think it's payback time for a little tea party they threw for us a few hundred years ago. I say we go down to those docks tonight and dump that crap where everything from the ulcered sphincter of our Serica belongs. Who's with me? Who's bloody with me? Did you like that? USA, ulcered sphincter of our Serica. I mean, what else can you say? Here was a country that had everything, absolutely everything. And now, 20 years later, is what? The world's biggest leper colony. Why? Godlessness. Let me say that again. Godlessness. It wasn't the war they started. It wasn't the plague they created. It was judgment. No one escapes their past. No one escapes judgment. You think he's not up there? You think he's not watching over this country? How else can you explain it? He tested us, and we came through. We did what we had to do. Islington, Enfield, I was there, I saw it all. Immigrants, Muslims, homosexuals, terrorists, disease-ridden degenerates. They had to go. Strength through unity. Unity through faith. I'm a God-fearing Englishman, and I'm goddamn proud of it.
That's quite enough of that. Thank you very much.
And while this is happening, we meet V and Evie separately getting ready for a night out and getting ready in their respective mirrors.
They're both watching The Voice of London.
Exactly.
Who's kind of this Bill Riley-esque, not hate-mongering, although it is kind of hate-mongering, but he's kind of deeply, it seems deeply religious, kind of.
It's both religious and conservative. Pro-government.
And very much just a load of propaganda.
Exactly. Well, as we'll learn, it's a very 1984 London where the government is run by the Norse Fire Party, and instead of a prime minister, they have the High Chancellor. And then all the parts of government are labeled, and in the comic it's more easily seen, but you've got the fingermen, and you have the ears and the eyes, and it's all part of the government, the body politic, if you will.
Oh, see, that makes more sense, because I never understood, because it's never clear why they're called the fingermen.
Yes, it's because they're part of the hand of government. Yeah,
I see.
Yeah, all the parts of government.
That makes me feel more enlightened.
And, by the way, in the graphic novel, Evie, I believe, is a prostitute, and she's out late because of that. But in the movie, she is out. She's going out to meet with a colleague, like a romantic kind of late night. Rendezvous is not the right word, but she's basically going on a date. And she's out.
She's going to Gordon's house, I think.
Yes.
And his beard.
Well, yeah, because Gordon is a ladies' man, although it turns out he's not. But we learn that a little bit later.
No, he's more of a lady boy.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, that's a joke.
But she doesn't know that he's...
You don't know that Gordon's batting for my team at that point.
Exactly. And Gordon, by the way, is the host of like a variety show. And both Evie and Gordon, work for the British television network, BTN, which Prothero works for as well.
Yeah, and Gordon's show is kind of a mix between Johnny Carson and Benny Hill.
Yeah, exactly. Especially what we see of it actually has Yakety Sax right in there.
Yes.
We are told that in the late 2020s, the world is in turmoil, and the United States has been fractured, going through a civil war as a result of a prolonged conflict, and a pandemic of St. Mary's virus has ravaged the European continent. Now, the UK remains the only stable country being ruled by the fascist Norse Fire Party, referred to simply as the Party. This is all, by the way, through a Wikipedia plot summary. By the way, I'm relying less and less on Wikipedia plot summaries, but because they are written by, you know, the masses, they often skim over important details, which is why if you look at the first, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 episodes of this podcast, you'll see where Eric goes off on a, I miss important parts of movies because they weren't specifically mentioned in the plot summary.
Yes.
So now I have to watch the movie at least once while taking notes. Otherwise, I'll miss important parts. Anyway, so, sorry, I'll close the curtain again. Back to our regularly scheduled programming. So, the UK is the only stable country. It's ruled by the fascist Norse Fire Party, referred to simply as the Party. Society is heavily oppressed. Political opponents, immigrants, Muslims, homosexuals, and other undesirables are imprisoned in concentration camps. So, on the 5th of November, Guy Fawkes Night, Evie Hammond, played by Natalie Portman, she works at, as we said before, the state-run British television network. She's out past curfew and is accosted by members of the Fingermen, the secret police, and they are going to rape her. But she is rescued by a vigilante with a Guy Fawkes mask who identifies himself as V. We get a nice little action scene here and no deaths, which, by the way, nice action scenes are throughout this movie and the no deaths don't last very long.
Well, except that I don't know. I think he kills the one guy.
Maybe the very guy, and the guy at the very, very end.
Because he says, spoil the rod, spare the child.
Yeah, and he was reaching for a gun, too, so.
Yeah, and because the noise, the sound effect that accompanied it, and I had it in my surround sound, so it was loud, and, you know, it was booming, and anyway, it sounded much like the wet, slurpy, you know, bad Hollywood kill noises.
And then, in our introduction to V.
By the way, that's going to be my next band name, Bad Hollywood Death Noises.
Ah, there you go. That's not bad. So V gives a very V speech. You'll find this movie has a lot of the letter V in it.
I can assure you I mean you no harm.
Who are you?
Who? Who is but the form following the function of what? And what I am is a man in a mask.
Well, I can see that.
Of course you can. I'm not questioning your powers of observation. I'm merely remarking upon the paradox of asking a masked man who he is.
Oh, right.
But on this most auspicious of nights, permit me then, in lieu of the more commonplace sobriquet, to suggest the character of this dramatis persona. Voila! In view, a humble vaudevillian veteran, cast vicariously as both victim and villain by the vicissitudes of fate. This visage, no mere veneer of vanity, is a vestige of the vox populi, now vacant, vanished. However, this valorous visitation of a bygone vexation stands vivified and has vowed to vanquish these venal and virulent vermin, vanguarding vice and vouchsafing the violently vicious and voracious violation of volition. The only verdict is vengeance, a vendetta, held as a votive, not in vain, for the value and veracity of such shall one day vindicate the vigilant and the virtuous. Verily, this vicious soise of verbiage veers most verbose, so let me simply add that it's my very good honor to meet you, and you may call me V.
Are you like a crazy person?
I'm quite sure they will say so. But to whom might I ask am I speaking?
And it's something of a revelation when we find out why his name is V. it's really, I mean, in the book especially, when you finally figure out why he goes by V, it's sort of like a brilliant little thing.
It really, and the first time I saw the movie, I didn't get it.
Yeah, well, and I love the fact that Evie's reaction is, are you like a crazy person?
Well, because I think that's about, I mean, granted, this is a very different environment, but I think that would not be an inappropriate reaction.
Oh, no.
The mask guy with the big wig who is all kinds of, you know, all kinds of martial arts and or, you know, sword, knife throwing, wielding, bodyguard-esque kind of control, whips out of nowhere and then protects you and then just takes on these guys, but is then very much, you know, very much enamored with you and able to carry on just a calm conversation. That's pretty surreally kind of crazy.
Well, and also speaking in like the poetic language that he does, because he really lays the V's on strong in the beginning.
Yeah, he's full of alliteration, but I think most of the audiobooks I have, if they were read by Hugo Weaving in the voice of V, I think almost every book I have would be better. And because I know that's not Hugo Weaving's like normal metering and voice, but his character V, his voice is just so. I'm not sure. It's very pleasant though. It's a very pleasant voice, but it's very rich, and you know, it's part delivery, part timbre, and part depth.
It is, and it's very theatrical. But you know,
which is appropriate.
Well, can we talk about the mask on a brief mask tangent?
Sure.
I had read something. Oh no, I heard a podcast that talked about Michael Myers, the Halloween bad guy.
Yeah.
And one of the guys who has played Michael Myers, they had, when they talked about playing, actually, I think it was a guy who had played Jason Voorhees and another guy who played Michael Myers. They were in the same interview. And they talked about what it was like to act behind a mask. And the whole idea as an actor, because, you know, you don't want to play, even if you're, like, obviously the V character is very rich and you have to act it. Something like Jason or Michael, you can get away with a lot of just sort of lumbering and being a big guy, but you also have to have acting chops to make it believable, to sell it. And one of the things that one of the guys that played Michael said was that people asked him how many different Mike Myers masks he has, because in some scenes he looks very like super scary. In other scenes, he looks more like introspective and that kind of thing. And he's like, no, you know, you understand, it's all one mask. It's my delivery that makes you see different things. And I was actually looking for it the second time I watched this movie this week to see if there were different masks, and there weren't. Although in his delivery, the mask takes on different properties. You know, he can look very, you know, childish, and he can look kind of impish because he's got the smile, but it's not a pure smile on that mask.
No, it's more of a smirk.
Yeah. And so you can see, in some scenes, you know, just by dropping his head a little bit, you can see his sadness or his inner turmoil or his going to war face, even though it's all the same mask.
Well, and his body language and posture would also, I mean, it had an impact on that. Because, you know, there's some parts of this movie where you'll swear that he's, you know, you can see him talking, except that you never see him talking. You never see the mask move. You know, mechanically anyway. I mean, obviously it moves about on his head, but very minutely. But you're right. A lot of that the viewer projects into their head by seeing the body language, the posture, the movements, the context, and also just listening. Because, you know, he really did, I mean, Hugo Weaving did a fantastic job, because you really believed that this mask was a part of him.
By the way, also kudos to Natalie Portman for pulling off her accent all the way through.
I wrote that down, actually. I wrote, her accent, we shall see, .. Nope, she nailed it.
Yeah, all the way through. You know, Hugo Weaving, I don't give him as many points because I think that's probably his natural accent, but still.
Well, okay, but he carried on the voice.
Oh, no, Hugo Weaving gets a ton of credit for just being V. I mean, it's an amazing character, and his performance was stellar. So, after rescuing her from the rapist government officials, secret policemen, V leads her to a rooftop to watch his destruction of the Old Bailey Criminal Court building, accompanied by fireworks and the 1812 Overture. And that shows us what kind of movie we're in now. He is blowing up a building, and Evie, by the way, is impressed with it, but she's also scared because there's no freedom in this society, and he has been breaking all sorts of rules, not the least of which was attacking government employees and being a terrorist.
Yeah, I think the government employee ship kind of sailed once you started blowing up buildings.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, on the scheme of things, like, you know, it's that line from Sneakers, they're like, oh, they'll give us 30 years in the electric chair.
Yeah, exactly. At this point, after the Old Bailey is destroyed, this is where we meet the High Chancellor, Adam Sutler.
Sutler.
Played by John Hurt, who is magnificent as always.
Yeah, although... As if you watch, his eyes are like dilated almost fully the entire part of the entire movie.
Well, it's possible he is high as a kite.
Maybe, but it's a little disconcerting. So I don't know if that was on purpose as part of the movie or if that's just how kind of he is in his natural life. So I don't know, because, you know, he's under studio lights ostensibly as the politician, because he has, you know, a connection with the video cameras and everything. But even still, I mean, it was a little disconcerting.
Yeah, well, it's hard to tell because, yeah, you're right. He has some light on him, but he's also in extreme close-up in a lot of it.
So, like I said, it's hard to know if, like, that was, like, the actor's eyes were dilated or they did that as a choice in, like, a camera trick or some kind of CGI choice where they wanted to make him just kind of overwrought and constantly hyper amped, or, you know, I don't know if the implication is that he was also some kind of, you know, deranged drug fiend or something.
Well, the implication that he's deranged is certainly there. So that works for him, yeah.
Well, he's, you know, he's a dictator, really.
Well, oh, definitely. Yeah, he is definitely Hitler in this. I mean, you know, all the Norse fire party and, you know, the crosses and the black and the red. I mean, that's all Nazi, like, iconography. It falls in that same sort of very simple symbolism. Because if you think about it, you know, the flag of the United States of America is a little busy. Like, and the French flag or the Japanese flag is, I don't know, a little one note, but this has some drama to it with the flag and the, you know, but again, it's much like the Union Jack too.
Yeah. Well, the Union Jack is three flags together.
True. True. But it comes off in a very, it's very, you know, angular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the Union Jack. I think it's a pretty flag.
Yeah.
Our flag, I mean, and I don't mean to sound unpatriotic. Our flag is, you're right, it's kind of busy. It's very symbolic, of course. I mean, it's symbolic of the 13 colonies and the 50 states and, you know, but it is kind of an odd flag in comparison. Again, I'm not besmirching my flag. I like my flag very much. I'm patriotic as the next guy.
Well, and as the internet has told us, you know, Captain America's uniform really is he's really Captain Puerto Rico. If you look at his suit, it's really like the Puerto Rican flag, which is much simpler in its design. Anyhow, you'll have to look that up. Captain America, really Captain Puerto Rico.
Okay. I better write that down. Hang on.
Now you're just mocking me. It's like when telemarketers call and I'm like, yeah, let me write down your number. What is that number? And I don't know. Yeah. Anyway. Although, who answers the phone anymore?
Yeah, I was going to say, I never answer my home phone. I answer my cell phone, but I never answer my home phone.
Yeah.
I screen everything.
The first telecommuter that calls the first telemarketer. My God. Telemarketer. Yeah. The first telecommuter that calls my phone, I'll be like, what are you calling me for? I have a job. Anyway, first telemarketer that calls my cell phone, I'll be very unhappy.
Yeah, I think they're pretty good about not doing that. I've only had one telemarketer call, and I was like, "You're costing me money. Don't call again." Of course, now I'm on the do not call registry, but I think anymore that, you know, I think they're pretty good about that.
Yeah,
even though it doesn't cost me, but
yeah, I guess it just takes one. So anyway, okay, so. From John Hurt, now we meet the other. He's actually addressing his government officials because he is none too happy about, of course, the Old Bailey being blown up.
Well, when you think about that, though, you know, you're the leader of a country and, you know, somebody blows up one of your seats of power. That's going to be a little disconcerting.
Oh, yeah. It's an act of terrorism. But, of course, the first thing you want to do is cover it up. So they call it a scheduled demolition.
For safety reasons.
Yes. So funny. And, but anyway, then we meet the rest of it. Well, we meet another, turns out to be a heroic character, Inspector Finch, who's the chief inspector of Scotland Yard, played by Stephen Ray, who is, by the way, I love Stephen Ray.
Yeah. I don't know what else he's been in, but he was great in this. So, you know, he was well chosen.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I wish I had his filmography in front of me. But he has been in a lot of stuff, and I really like him a lot. He and Gabriel Byrne, I think, should star in a buddy cop movie together, if they haven't already.
Oh, dear.
So, Inspector Finch, is tasked to investigate V's activities, and the government uses the BTN to declare this was an emergency demolition, and then we meet the talk show host Gordon Dietrich, Stephen Fry, who is also national treasure of whatever country he's from, and he was the one to whom Evie was en route the night she was attacked.
And there's some hubbub amongst the talk in the studio, because Evie works in the studio, in, you know, kind of the studio support area, about how, you know, the blowing up of the Old Bailey is bullshit, that they know that the government's lying to them.
Yeah, and Evie, we find out rather quickly, but because Finch finds out that Evie was with V because they have video cameras of everything from the eye of government, they find out that Evie's parents were political activists. We learn a little bit more about that later. But so Evie is not all who she seems either. She's not just your average person either, as far as her background. She's already nervous, and she does not engage in this talk of the government story is bullshit. Because, of course, she was there with the guy.
Right. She doesn't want any more attention on her in any way.
Exactly. She's sort of skittish as her default setting. So Finch is finds out that Evie is with V, but wants to go to BTN to interview her before party leader Creedy's secret police comes to take her in a black bag operation, which also we learn more about those later, too. As Evie is, she's already getting ready probably to bug out, but V walks into the BTN, into what is it called, Jordan Towers?
Yeah, Jordan Towers.
Yeah, wearing a bomb vest and takes over the broadcast to claim responsibility and to play a video of his own, announcing that...
Good evening, London. Allow me first to apologize for
this emergency channel.
I do, like many of you, appreciate the comforts of the everyday routine, the security of the familiar, the tranquility, repetition.
Bloody hell.
I enjoy them as much as any bloke. But in the spirit of commemoration, whereby those important events of the past, usually associated with someone's death or the end of some awful bloody struggle, are celebrated with a nice holiday, I thought we could mark this November the 5th, a day that is sadly no longer remembered, by taking some time out of our daily lives to sit down and have a little chat. There are, of course, those who do not want us to speak.
Let me think.
Even now, orders are being shouted into telephones, and men with guns will soon be on their way.
It's Chancellor Sutler.
Damn it!
Why? Because while the truncheon may be used in lieu of conversation, words will always retain their power. Words offer the means to meaning, and for those who will listen, the enunciation of truth. And the truth is, there is something terribly wrong with this country, isn't there?
You designed it, sir. You wanted it foolproof. You told me every television in London.
Cruelty and injustice, intolerance and oppression. And where once you had the freedom to object, to think and speak as you saw fit, you now have sensors and systems of surveillance coercing your conformity and soliciting your submission.
We need cameras.
How did this happen? Who's to blame? Well, certainly there are those who are more responsible than others, and they will be held accountable. But again, truth be told, if you're looking for the guilty, you need only look into a mirror. I know why you did it. I know you were afraid. Who wouldn't be? War, terror, disease. There were a myriad of problems which conspired to corrupt your reason and rob you of your common sense. Fear got the best of you, and in your panic you turned to the now High Chancellor, Adam Sutler. He promised you order, he promised you peace, and all he demanded in return was your silent, obedient consent.
Inspector, you're almost through.
Last night, I sought to end that silence. Last night, I destroyed the Old Bailey to remind this country of what it has forgotten. More than 400 years ago, a great citizen wished to embed the 5th of November forever in our memory. His hope was to remind the world that fairness, justice, and freedom are more than words. They are perspectives. So if you've seen nothing, if the crimes of this government remain unknown to you, then I would suggest that you allow the 5th of November to pass unmarked. But if you see what I see, if you feel as I feel, and if you would seek as I seek, then I ask you to stand beside me 1 year from tonight, outside the gates of Parliament, and together we shall give them a 5th of November that shall never, ever be forgotten.
Yeah, he's kind of setting the stage for his big plan, what he's got going on for the next year or so.
Yeah. Which is kind of a bold thing to announce exactly what you're going to do a year from now.
I think it's so big that you get the idea that, like, oh dear, this guy is absolutely crazy. And so I think the implication is that it's so crazy, it'll never happen, which is what the government says. Oh, this, you know, it won't happen.
Oh, of course not. Yeah. Well, I think everybody wants to believe it won't happen because, you know, V may be taking on the government that you don't like, but he blew up a building, and so that's sort of scary.
And though it's a government they don't like, it's a government that's protected and coddled them to the point where, you know, they're insulated, and, you know, they talk about the war in America and the crazy virus and, you know, all these things that they've now kind of, they're complicit by their kind of their security.
Exactly. Exactly. They are secure because they are relatively virus-free, and they don't have the internal conflict because they have ultimate control over society.
Although, they're rationed, and, you know, there's order, and there's a curfew, and, you know, it's a very kind of structured society where, you know, you'd say they've given up their freedom to a great degree for safety and security.
Exactly. So, which is interesting because it's also something we face as Americans.
Yep.
Anyway, BTN is the only television station, as far as we can tell, because everybody seems to be watching it. It's not quite 1984, although the surveillance is as much. You know, there's complete surveillance, both audio and video surveillance. And when you only have one source of news, they can put whatever kind of news they want on there. And whether you believe it or not, that's all your information you're being given, which is also something that maybe is important to us today. Anyhow.
Certainly ponderous.
Yeah. So they're evacuating the building anyway because of V and his bomb vest. But Finch is on his way in as Evie's on her way out. And Finch sees Evie. And Evie sees that Finch wants to talk to her because, you know. And so she takes off running and eventually eludes him. So now we know she's on the run anyway. So we get this wonderful TV speech from V. Now, during the broadcast, the police attempt to capture him. But V is pretty clever, as we're going to find out throughout this movie. And he has tied up a bunch of the BTN employees and put them basically in the whole V costume with the black cape and the mask and the hair. And then the action starts again. And this time, he's outright killing cops.
Yeah, there's no ambiguity. He is setting up people to be killed.
Exactly. And Evie eventually helps V escape, but is knocked out in the process. So V takes Evie to his home. By the way, the BTN broadcasts a news report saying the V has been killed in the terrorist attempt because they end up defusing the bomb. Anyway, so Evie wakes up in V's house, which is, by the way, called the Shadow Gallery, where she's told that she must remain until the following November 5th. Like, for a whole year. Like, locked in the house. Luckily, the house is filled with all sorts of art and music and books, which have been stolen, as it turns out, from the Ministry of Objectionable Materials. By the way, that's a great name for a ministry. If you're going to have a ministry, have it be of objectionable materials.
Yeah, no, I want to be in charge of that and review everything.
Oh, of course. So we learn that Evie's parents were revolutionaries and taken to camps where they died, and that her brother was in St. Mary's, presumably a hospital, during whatever happened. So that tells us a little bit more about her backstory. Then we have a scene where we have Prothero in the shower. Prothero, of course, being our Bill O'Reilly figure. He is in the shower watching his own show and talking along with himself.
Yeah, kind of it's totally expected, but a total prick dick move. Like, you understand so much about his character just by that scene.
Oh, absolutely. It's fantastic. And then, of course, V pays a visit. And this is where we find out that Prothero, the voice of London, was also a commander at the Lark Hill Detention Center, where V was a prisoner. Now, we don't know anything more about it at this point than there was a detention center and V was there and he was a commander at it. But what we do know is V has a score to settle, and so Prothero was killed, and V leaves a rose on his chest. So Finch tries to find out about Lark Hill, but the government has hidden its existence. And again, we're not really given the whole backstory on what has happened until a little bit later, but it kind of ratchets up the tension in a nice, nice way.
One point of clarification. Scarlett Carson, not a rose.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Scarlett Carson is a different type of flower?
Yes.
Okay, I did not know
that. That's a plot point.
Yes, I'm sorry. It was a flower that was presumed to be extinct. Anyway, so as we have Finch trying to investigate V, and V out there killing people one at a time now, Evie comes to V and tells him her backstory.
There's something I want to ask you, but I don't think you understand why unless you know a few things about me. My father was a writer. You would have liked him. He used to say that artists use lies to tell the truth while politicians use them to cover the truth up.
A man after my own heart.
You always told the best stories. Until my brother died. That was when everything changed. My brother was one of the students at St. Mary's. After he died, my parents became political. They protested the war and the reclamation. When Sutler was appointed High Chancellor, they were at the riot in Leeds. I watched on the television, thinking I was going to see my parents killed. I remember them arguing at night. Mum wanted to leave the country. Dad refused. He said if we ran away, they would win. Win, like. It was a game.
Evie, quick, hide!
It was like those black bags erased them from the face of the earth.
I'm sorry, Evie.
No, I'm the one that's sorry. Sorry I'm not a stronger person. Sorry I'm not like my parents. I wish I was, but I'm not. I wish I wasn't afraid all the time, but I am. I know this world is screwed up. Believe me, I know it better than most. Which is why I wanted to ask if there's anything I can do to help make it right. Please let me know.
If you wish.
Now that V finds out that she's got this fire burning within her, and that she has been, she's always been afraid of the government, after this event, of course, because, you know, it's a very traumatic event. So that's why she is so skittish. Well, V asks her if she's willing to help. And she then says yes. That's when she's asked to help kill a perverted priest, Bishop Lilliman, who's played by John Standing. And she has to pretend to be a child prostitute.
And he's a creepy priest, by the way. But that whole kind of situation is weird, how the indulgence was just expected of the priest. Like, it was just, like, commonplace.
Oh, he had done this well before. I mean, he had a service all set up that was only unusual in this case because it was a girl from not the same service, apparently, and the person that was, I don't remember his title, the priest or whatever, who was arranging it, was a little concerned that she might be too old for the bishop state. But luckily, the bishop likes what he sees. And she, at that point, whether in earnest or not, you can't really tell at this point in the game, but she starts to tell him, look, there is somebody coming here to kill you. I'm not here to pleasure you sexually. I'm here to warn you that this guy is going to come and kill you.
Oh, no, she's in earnest. She's trying to get free. Because her whole thing was, because earlier in the movie, you know, she looked at the address, the torn envelope that she had of Gordon's address, and she was like, I can do this, which is when she went to V and said, I'm sorry about before, if there's anything I can do to help. And he was like, you know, do you mean that? Which is when, of course, you know, my bad V voice impersonation right there.
Oh, no, I was gonna compliment your V voice impersonation.
You know, that's when, she tries to help out, and her whole, she'd already thought ahead, which is kind of not unlike V, where she was like, okay, if I help V out, I know Gordon's address, I just have to get free, and I can go to Gordon's house, which is what she was trying to do, and what she actually did. You know, she was talking to the priest and like, you know, this guy's coming to kill you. We don't have much time. And then that's when, you know, V dropped in, and while he was busy killing the bishop, she took off for Gordon's.
Exactly. Yeah. So she shows up on
in earnest when she was talking to the bishop, like, somebody's trying to kill you. Now, I don't think she cared that the bishop was going to be killed in any way. She just wanted kind of distraction or help to get away.
Well, yeah, she was a prisoner of V's, most definitely. She could not leave. It was all locked doors for her in the Shadow Gallery. So it may have been a nice place to be, but she was still a prisoner. So you're right, she wanted to get away. So she slips out while V is dispatching the bishop, and she ends up on the doorstep of Gordon, who welcomes her in, and he's got his own little Shadow Gallery thing going on, because he, you know, he's a very successful man, and he's managed to secret away art, and it turns out that he has an antique Koran, and he also has Robert Mapplethorpe photos. So, anyway, he explains that even though she's a terrorist and coming to him, she's a little upset that her going to him was going to endanger him. And he says that, you know, if the police come to search my home, finding her will be the least of his problems.
Which is true and profound.
Yes.
And prophetic.
Yeah. So he explains his whole thing about how he's acted the part as a womanizer to conceal his homosexuality. And there's a nice little speech.
What is that?
It's a copy of the Quran, 14th century.
Are you a Muslim?
No, I'm in television.
But why would you keep it?
I don't have to be Muslim to find the images beautiful or its poetry moving.
But is it worth it? I mean, if they found that here.
I told you, you'd be the least of my worries.
Thank you, Gordon. Thank you so much.
It's all right.
You know, this whole thing started the night he blew up the Old Bailey, and I was on my way here and...
Ah. Yes. You see, we're both fugitives in our own way.
But?
You're wondering why you were invited here to supper in the first place, if my appetites were for less conventional fare. Unfortunately, a man in my position is expected to entertain young and attractive ladies like yourself. Because in this world, if I were to invite who I desired, I would undoubtedly find myself without a home, let alone a television show.
I'm sorry.
Not as sorry as I am. And the truth is, after so many years, you begin to lose more than just your appetite. You wear a mask for so long, you forget who you were beneath it.
Which, again, is commentary not only on that, but also on V himself. So, Inspector Finch, who has now been told on no uncertain terms by several members of the government, including Creedy, he needs to step away from looking into the past. But he learns that V is a result of experimentation on humans, and his targets, the targets that people V is trying to kill, were ones that tortured him while he was being detained. And there's only one person left on that list, and that is the coroner, who...
Well, but you don't know that yet.
Well, it doesn't take very long until you find, because Finch is talking to the coroner about it and about the flower that was left on the bishop. And as Finch has just discovered that the coroner is the last person on the list or the next person that V is going to be killing, V is already visiting her house. And she is actually quite upset about the whole thing. And we get a nice little exposition on what really happened at Lark Hill. And when Finch finds her body, he also finds a notebook or a diary she has written about the events of Lark Hill.
Well, it's kind of her running journal of being at Lark Hill.
Yes, yes, and how she is disillusioned as to what's going on. By the way, there's a really powerful mass grave scene because they're doing these experiments and people are dying, and these prisoners or patients are being basically thrown dead into this pit and having lime shoveled over them.
Yeah.
But it's also where we meet a character named Valerie for the first time, although we don't know she's going to be important.
Right. It's a very disturbing kind of Auschwitz Nazi-esque kind of throwback scene, by the way.
Most definitely. Yeah, it's a concentration camp, straight up Nazi thing.
It's kind of a chilling scene. I've seen the movie enough times now where I know it's coming, so I think I've broken myself inside, I guess, a little bit, because I'm kind of desensitized a little bit to that. It still bothers me, though, which is, I guess, a good thing. But it's a shocking scene. I mean, oh. it's you see the diseased people in the camp, and the, you know, their wounds and their festering, you know, pustules and being in the cages with the excrement. And I mean, I give them credit in the visuals in this movie. They didn't pull a lot of punches.
Oh, and the prisoners look broken. There's no fight left in them.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are no defiant prisoners, except, as we turns out, V. But then we have a very nice little exposition scene where we find out that Finch has a little jammer that can allow him to have private conversations with his subordinate inspector. And he says the line, "What if the worst biological attack in the country's history was not the work of religious extremists, and that the government was maybe involved?"
Yeah, it was his assistant, Dominic.
Yeah, and that's a profound question, because if you work for the government and you believe in your country, especially in a time of, let's say, a high level of nationalism, you know, I certainly don't believe 9/11 was an inside job, but if I did, that would change the way I looked at everything.
Oh, it would certainly color your whole universe.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I mean, and that, I think that it was a very profound kind of statement at the time. And it still holds a lot of power now when you see the performance, because that's a question that I would have to ask myself. I'm like, would you really want to know? Would you want to know? Especially working for the institution, knowing that, you know, because you get the impression repeatedly that Dietrich, you know, he doesn't have as much power as people pretend that he does around him.
You mean?
And I think he knows.
Do you actually mean Finch?
Oh, I'm sorry, Finch, yes. But I see Dietrich.
Yeah.
I get the D's mixed up, because there's a lot of D's in this. There's a lot of D's in this, which is funny, because there's Dominic, there's Dietrich, and then there's Dascom, and there's Delia. So there's a lot of D's.
Oh, a lot of D's to go with the V's.
Yes.
Ah, interesting.
So make your own BD jokes right there. Yeah, but, but you get the impression that Finch doesn't have as much power as people around him want him to think he has or want to portray that he has. And I think he's well aware that he's on a really short leash, especially because the Fingermen come in and yank his leash constantly. But, you know, he really wants to do the right thing, but he's also very limited because he's kind of pit between, you know, the Chancellor and the truth.
Well, and he is essentially, he's a cop in the purest sense. He just wants to get to the truth. And so in that sense, he's putting himself in jeopardy, but he doesn't have a choice really. So Finch is actually having a little bit of personal crisis in this whole thing. And every time he's told by somebody else that he needs to stop sniffing around that direction, it just confirms his suspicions. And by now, the whole, you know, the High Chancellor is, let's say, I don't know what the word, it's not paranoid if it's all real, right? I mean, the Chancellor, you know, the Chancellor needs to have control over everything. And he is telling his subordinates that you are to take control of the situation or you are to consider the consequences. And since these are the people in the case of like Creedy and the Fingerman of, you know, they can each themselves get black bagged too, theoretically. Because when Prothero is killed, it's actually like a day of national mourning because he's the voice of London and he had an unexpected heart attack.
Yeah, I don't know, because he was, you know, he was the force and voice of the propaganda machine, and now the propaganda machine has no leader.
Yeah, well, and it's about to get worse propaganda-wise, because as Finch is finding out more and more about what happened at St. Mary's and Lark Hill, Gordon and Evie are talking about, you know, Gordon's double life. In fact, at one point, Evie finds it strange that Gordon is acting a little like V, and Gordon says, "I am V, you found it out," which is sort of a funny moment. And then, in the funniest part of this whole movie, Gordon turns on his show and opens a bottle of champagne that he shares with Evie because it's going to be the show of his career. And he performs a satire of the government in which Yakety Sax is played.
Yeah, which is a brilliant satire, by the way.
Yes. And unfortunately, and of course, this totally scares Evie because she's worried about him. And he's like, no, what are they going to do, fire me? You know, worst case, he'll get a fine. And then in the meantime, it'll be a huge ratings coup.
Right.
Unfortunately, the government takes a dim view. And in the night, his home is raided. And in a basically a replay of what happened to her parents, Gordon is black bag right in front of her as she's under the bed. And then she tries to escape, but is captured at the last minute.
And she, nearly identical to what happened to her mother in front of her, by the way.
Oh, exactly. Very, very traumatic.
Except this time, I mean, it's you see the fingerman. You see very clearly. You see him handling Gordon. But so and it wasn't the government that took the dim view. It was Sutler that took a dim view, because you see him with his glass of milk watching this show.
Oh yes,
see him, you know, crushing the glass in his hand. Which, how? I mean, I don't mean to be overly critical, but how often does that really happen in real life that somebody shatters a glass?
You probably never. I mean, it seems like glasses are fairly sturdy, aren't they?
Well, and if you would be more likely to put a shard of glass through your hand if you were to squeeze it that tightly. So.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It would be bad.
But yeah. You're right. So that's when, you know, Evie makes her escape. Is she, you know, she runs up from the bed and you know, drops down from the windowsill, and she's trying to, you know, get to the ground, where she kind of lands on her ankle and falls and runs. But this is one of the plot points that I don't understand. How is it that V knew to be there at that time? How did that he just happened? And I know you don't realize it's V yet, so, you know, spoilers, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
But V grabs her and takes her back to jail, to a jail cell. But how is it that he knew to be there? Like, it just happened that he knew that they were going to get into Gordon's house just then?
Well, here's a possible way around this plot-wise. He does have Gordon's address. She left it at his house.
Sure.
So he knows where she's going, so he could just observe her like he seems to observe lots of people and get into lots of strange places.
I suppose.
Yeah, but anyway, so she is taken, imprisoned at a secret location, and she is processed as a prisoner. They shave her head, and she is tortured in many ways. And basically the question is, who's V? And she refuses to give the answer. And you get the sense that this torture lasts a long time. And she is in the cell all by herself. And she finds, in a little hole in the wall, she finds a note written by a former occupant of that cell, whose name is Valerie Page. And this is, well, first of all, I mean, darn them for not having the note written on toilet paper like it's supposed to be. Because it's clearly not toilet paper.
Yeah, I actually wrote a note. I'm like, that is some awfully solid and probably uncomfortable toilet paper.
Exactly. I mean, there's no reason why they couldn't use toilet paper for real.
Well, except that it would have never held up in the water.
Well, you know, put it in a bag, sort it out. That was the story. Or don't mention in the movie that it's toilet paper. Because it's part of the story that it's toilet paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, also, she hides it in her toilet. Like under the, like in the P trap or something. It's like, how does that work? Why not just put it back in the hole?
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway. I don't know. But I'm with you. I mean, it was one of the things that really kind of.
I think it's the only part of it that took me out of it.
Yeah, I think I'm the same way. I think it was one of the few notes that didn't ring true.
Yeah. That being said, Valerie's story is really, really a harrowing tale and very sad.
It's very compelling.
And it's so well told, and the visuals are amazing. So, you know, Valerie basically tells her this whole very personal story that she's been arrested for being a lesbian and put in this camp, and all through it, you know, she's basically her whole life just looking for love, but she tells the person, you know, reading this, that even though she's never met them and, you know, she is going to die, she still loves them with all of her heart. It's all very, very touching. And it's something that Evie clings to and just strengthens her resolve not to tell on V.
Well, I mean, it touches her emotionally at a point where she's, you know, volatilely vulnerable and also kind of almost, I mean, she's broken really at that point, you know, because she has become her parents.
Exactly. But she is not going to tell who V is. That's the one thing that she's not going to do. So at the very end, she's told she's going to be executed. She's going to be taken back behind the chemical sheds and shot.
Right.
And offered again a chance of not having that. In fact, even the guard, kind of, after she says no, he kind of takes on a more like conspiratorial tone, saying, "Listen, chick, just say something, make it up, whatever." And she said, no, she'd rather die. And at that time, she's told that, you know, then she has no fear. And if she has no fear, then she's free. And the guard just walks away. And with the cell door open, and she looks through the cell, and she sees that the guard at the end of the hallway is actually a mannequin, and she opens up the door, and she's in the shadow gallery. V has done this to her all along. And the scene where Evie kind of stumbles into the shadow gallery and confronts V is really well done.
Hello, Evie.
You. It was you.
Yeah.
That wasn't real. It's gone.
I'm sorry, but Mr. Dietrich's dead. I thought they'd arrest him, but when they found a Quran in his house, they had him executed.
Oh, God.
Fortunately, I got to you before they did.
You got to me. You did this to me. You cut my hair. You tortured me. You tortured me. Why?
You said you wanted to live without fear. I wish there'd been an easier way, but there wasn't.
Oh, my God.
I know you may never forgive me, but nor will you ever understand how hard it was for me to do what I did. Every day I saw in myself everything you see in me now. Every day I wanted to end it. But each time you refused to give in, I knew I couldn't.
You're sick! You're evil!
You could have ended it, Evie. You could have given in, but you didn't. Why?
Leave me alone! I hate you!
That's it! See, at first, I thought it was hate, too. Hate was all I knew. It built my world, imprisoned me, taught me how to eat, how to drink, how to breathe. I thought I'd die with all the hate in my veins. But then something happened. It happened to me, just as it happened to you.
Shut up! I don't want to hear your lies!
Your own father said that artists use lies to tell the truth. Yes, I created a lie. But because you believed it, you found something true about yourself.
No!
What was true in that cell is just as true now. What you felt in there has nothing to do with me.
I can't feel anything anymore!
Don't run from it, Evie. You've been running all your life. Listen to me, Evie. This may be the most important moment of your life. Commit to it. They took your parents from you. They took your brother from you. They put you in a cell and took everything they could take, except your life. And you believed that was all there was, didn't you? But the only thing you had left was your life, but it wasn't, was it?
Please.
You found something else. In that cell, you found something that mattered more to you than life. Because when they threatened to kill you unless you gave them what they wanted, you told them you'd rather die. You faced your death, Evie. You were calm. You were still. Try to feel now what you felt then.
Yeah, no, and just, so I just want to back up just a little bit. So, by the way, when V is in the cell telling her, like, come on, just, you know, they just want to know, just to give them what they want and you can be free. You know, that whole speech, he's Agent Smith at that point.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Plus, you see his face.
Do you?
Yes.
Okay.
If you watch, you actually see, there's a couple frames, because I noticed it. You see his face also, I was looking at some of the trivia. You actually see his hands when he's shaving her hair.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. Well, you'll notice that even though the
burns on the hand.
Well, that's funny. Yeah. They, you know, even though he refers to other people, there's only one other person with him. I mean, there's only one person. There's only him. There's no more than one person ever.
Right. It's just him.
Yeah. So even though he yells orders at other people and he refers to having several people come in, that never actually happens. It's just him.
Because he's crazy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Turns out he's not a nice guy.
No.
Yeah. Because he basically destroys this young woman. Although he says he does this to free her from her fear. And it's a really good scene. We'll have to back up in a second because we've already passed the point where you find out why his name is V. At least the audience finds out. But it's an interesting thing because what has happened in Larkhill was that they were working on a biological weapon. And they have come up with this great biological weapon and it works. And there's only one prisoner who turned out to have an immunity to it. And that was the prisoner in cell 5. 5 being marked in Roman numerals by V. And on the 5th of November of whatever year this was, there was an explosion, presumably caused by V, where it burned down the facility and the prisoner escaped. And you see him, like, walking out of the fire, all on fire, basically. He's being baptized by fire. And in this scene where Evie realizes that V was her captor all along, she ends up walking out into the rain because of this thing that Valerie says in her story about God being in the rain. So where V was baptized by fire, Evie is baptized by rain. And if you haven't figured it out by now, V is the hero of the story, or the anti-hero. Evie is the heroine of the story. And Valerie is, you know, the other heroic figure in the story. It's all V's, people. It's all V's. Not in a Creepy Way, we'll be back after these messages. As always, we'd love feedback. Call us on our feedback hotline at 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. And we're back. So V was baptized by fire, and now Evie has just been baptized by rain. And although it was revealed that her imprisonment and torture were all staged by V to free her from her fears, she finds out that the note itself was real, and it was passed from Valerie to V years earlier when they were similarly imprisoned. So Evie, initially, and understandably, hates V for what he did to her. But she does realize she's a stronger person, and she leaves. He says now she doesn't have fear, there are no more locked doors for her. But she does promise to return sometime before November 5th. So at this point, Finch searches for the true identity of V, and eventually traces him to a bioweapons program at a detention center for social deviants and political dissidents, which is what Larkhill is. Eventually, to get the whole story, he meets with a gentleman by the name of William Rookwood, who tells him that the program directed by then Undersecretary Sutler resulted in the creation of the St. Mary's virus, and its release was the brainchild of Creedy. Rather than use it on your enemies, use it on your own citizens as a false flag terrorist attack, and that way you can gain control over them. Because as it turns out, all of these guys have the cure to the virus as well. So they get rich off the pharmaceutical rights to the cure, and they gain power because of the terror that's caused by 100,000 people being killed.
Yeah, but how did they get the cure?
They got the cure because one prisoner, the prisoner in cell 5, had some sort of biological immunity. And that, my friends, is V. So with his own blood, they developed the cure and they got rich and killed 100,000 people and create this totalitarian state. So a couple weeks after this meeting where all is just given to Finch, now he knows the whole story. But he finds out that Rookwood has been dead for years, and that the man he met was really V in disguise. So Finch is pissed.
Right, because he doesn't understand. I mean, he's been played by V because V is trying to set up. It's V's whole plan to set up Creedy so that Creedy's under surveillance, so that it adds the paranoia to make him help V get Sutler.
Well, and this is where we have a really nice scene intercut with the action of all the other players. We have V setting up these dominoes. That's really nice visually.
Well, which I actually wrote down because it kind of gave me flashbacks of my childhood at Grandma's, when hanging out with Grandma at the Jerry's house.
That's true. That is true. Hardwood floors and dominoes.
Yeah, and stairs. All kinds of odd stairs because it was such an odd house.
Yeah, and Mad Magazine.
Yep. And ham radio.
Ham radio, yes. And gourmet food, which means it had weird crap in it.
Tacos with raisins.
Yeah, there were lots of raisins and currants going on. And, of course, onions, because Jerry loved himself some onions.
Yeah, and candles.
Yeah, they made candles. They did a lot of hobby kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It wasn't actually a bright time in our grandmother's life, but it was an interesting time.
Yeah, it was interesting for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, so back to V and his vendetta. As the pieces are placed, V distributes thousands of Guy Fawkes masks throughout the population. And everything is coming to a head because the government is getting progressively tighter and tighter on the security. And on the eve of November 5th, we did have this other domino being placed where Creedy, V meets with Creedy. And they make a deal for V to surrender in exchange for Sutler's execution. And V sets it up where he tells Creedy that Sutler is going to get rid of Creedy at some point because Creedy is a liability. So either Creedy can take this opportunity to use this to his advantage and to V's advantage, or he can just deal with the fact that he is going to be blackbagged himself. So because Creedy is not stupid and because he knows the writing's on the wall, he, after thinking about it, reluctantly agrees to V's plan. And on the eve of November 5th, Evie visits V, who shows her an explosives-laden train at an abandoned London underground tunnel. And it's all set to destroy Parliament. But he leaves it with Evie to decide whether or not to use it because he now believes that he is unfit to make that decision. So it's all in her power. He says, look, you throw the lever or don't. It's all up to you. I'm going to go get Sutler. That's going to be his reward. And whether or not she fulfills his plan is all up to her.
Well, because as he said, you know, he realized that he was doing vengeance for the sake of doing vengeance and not for the sake of doing justice, which is what he was telling himself he was doing it for. And so he's going to get some personal vengeance for Sutler for what's done to him. But rather than altering, you know, a big societal timeline that he may not necessarily even be able to inherit, he wanted to put it in Evie's hands since it was really her future and giving her the, you know, empowering her to choose her future for herself and for the future of the country.
Exactly. And you're absolutely right. He is not going to inherit it because he fully intends to die. He doesn't think he's going to make it out of this.
Yeah, he goes into this expecting his mortality.
Exactly. And that seems to be okay with him too.
Yeah, he's made peace with himself and his decisions. Yes. But this is also, I mean, you get the impression this has been a long time coming.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I mean,
he planned so much, and you know, years of work and the masks and you know the resource and the time and.
Oh, and he laid some of this track underground himself. I mean, didn't he talk about like 10 years of clearing the track and laying some of his own?
Yeah.
So it's been a very long time. Also, he also sort of confesses his love for Evie, and it's very touching because they end up with this. She gives him one last kiss, or one kiss. I mean, it's their only kiss, and it's on the mask, which I think was pretty great. I mean, the fact that they didn't take off the mask was very important.
Yeah, because there would have been no point to it other than it would have been the horror shock value.
This is a love story of idea and passion. It's not a physical love story.
Right.
So Anyway, like I said, it's late night on November 4th, approaching the midnight hour, and the Houses of Parliament are surrounded by military troops, including anti-aircraft and tanks and everything. And the people in London, they have their V masks and their capes. And as the High Chancellor is giving this impassioned speech, no one is watching, which is pretty great. Because throughout this thing, the Chancellor makes speeches or programs are broadcast and you see these people in their homes and in pubs watching. Not now. Nobody's watching the speech.
Well, part of that was the escalation in tension with the killing of the little girl by the Finger Man.
Well, and that was a really nice speech too, because when Finch, and Finch is a bedraggled kind of character. That's not the right word really, but he is, when he realizes, okay, this is all going down, and who was it that Dominic asked him, what do you think is going to happen? He goes, well, it's what always happens when a group of people without guns goes up against a group of people with guns.
Which is, it's pretty sterling commentary.
Oh, yeah. And he's pretty pessimistic about the whole thing, or realistic, or nihilistic, or he has his isms. He's
pretty pragmatic.
Yeah. And he's sort of resigned that this is not going to end well, and there's not much he can do about it. Although he's still going to continue to try to stop V, because again, he's a cop. That's what he does. So he ends up still exploring train stations, even though that was on a security report that he wrote, although nobody buys it because it was just a hunch.
Right.
It turns out ideas mean a lot in this movie, because ideas are important. And as V points out, ideas never die, or they don't die with one person. So V leaves the train in the hands of Evie, whether or not she's going to throw the switch when it comes midnight. And he goes to meet with Creedy. And Creedy and his little group of fingermen have fulfilled their bargain, and they brought in a sutler who Creedy shoots in the head.
Yeah, in kind of almost a shocking brazenness. I guess Creedy was pretty cold and heartless anyway, but it was just so completely and thoroughly just like, bam, it was done.
So yeah, so Creedy executes Sutler.
We bypassed one of my favorite lines in this whole movie, by the way.
Which is
when Evie comes back to visit V, you know, on the 4th, you know, he says that, you know, I've never danced.
I have a gift for you, Evie, but before I give it to you, I'd like to ask you something. Would you dance with me?
Now? On the eve of your revolution?
Oh, revolution without dancing is a revolution not worth having.
It is a great line. I mean, it really is kind of a fantastic line.
Yes, it is a great line. But then we have one of the better action sequences, and a very Matrix action sequence, where V reneges on his deal, and he's going to kill Creedy anyway, because he can't let Creedy escape. And Creedy is very smug about, look, you know, you have your knives, but we have all these guns. And then V gives a little thing about, no, you have bullets, and eventually you'll have to reload. And when you do, you better hope that I'm not standing here, because I will take you out. And then he proceeds to do just that.
In a very Matrix-esque fashion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is 100% Matrix. It's got slow motion. It's got the bullet cam, or in this case, the knife cam. It's got a gun battle with no headshots, conveniently.
Got a couple like over-the-top bloody moments, but none of it's especially gory, and none of it's especially graphic.
Oh, no, not really. It's very comic book violence.
Yeah, I mean, which is, I kind of appreciate that in a movie. It's like the emphasis isn't on the death as much as the killing.
Yeah, what he's doing is wrong, but he has the right reason in mind, I guess. But yeah, it's not glorifying the violence as much as it's just making it very stylized.
Well, is it really wrong? I mean, when you're in the spectrum of the right and wrong of the government, is it really wrong if he's liberating the people from the government of their oppression?
That's a good question, isn't it?
That's one of the problems that you wrestle with in the movie, is like the good guys are the bad guys, but the bad guys are bad guys too. And so it's who's the worst bad guy? Because there's no really good guy, with the exception of Evie, who seems to be pretty good, except what, you know, we don't know what wrath will be wrought upon by her and whether or not she blows up, you know, the government and what that will entail and if there's any civilians involved. I mean, so you don't ever see that part of it.
But this, again, this is not about that. This is about the higher minded ideals.
Right.
So basically, by the way, by killing Creedy, he has now decapitated the whole Norsefire government because the chancellor's gone. Now the Fingerman, the secret police chief is gone, or the party leader. The voice is gone and the bishop is gone. It's tied up rather nicely. If you're going to have a revolution, now it's more possible, especially when you have the people on your side. By the way, V's final speech, and I'm sorry, I really am sorry, because you're going to be listening to this now, not tonight, but you'll be listening to it now on your iPod. And V gives...
Well, actually, I will be listening to it in my car, most likely on my phone.
So, Brother Jay, I know when you're in your car, you might want to pull over now. Or if you're drinking a beverage, you might want to put it down now. Because there is a very moving final speech of V, which I'm going to insert here right now.
V! Oh, will you stop your bleeding?
Oh, please don't. I'm finished. I'm glad of it.
Don't say that.
I told you only truth. For 20 years, I saw only this day. Nothing else existed. Until I saw you. And then everything changed. I fell in love with you, Evie. Like I no longer believed I could.
Then I don't want you to die.
That's the most beautiful thing you could have ever given me.
V. V!
And we're back, and the speech is lovely. But now I want to compare and contrast, not the words, but the way the speech is given, with the following.
Montague was a gambling addict. Cards. He often got into marathon games of cribbage or whist that continued through day and night. He would refuse to leave the table, even to eat. But he did get hungry. At approximately 5 o'clock in the morning of August 6th, 1762, Montague ordered his manservant to make and bring him a simple, quick meal. And at that moment, quite unwittingly, our rather lackluster hero achieved immortality. Because what he told his man to do was just slap some roasted meat between two slices of bread. That's right. John Montague was also known as the Earl of Sandwich. Believe it? Or not.
And now we're back, and you can clean up whatever you spat out.
Pardon me.
You're just going to have to trust me on this as we're recording.
Okay.
So V gives a very impassioned speech that we just heard and then dies in Evie's arms, and Evie places V's body aboard the train, and just as it's about time to make the decision, she's found by Finch, and Finch is sufficiently disillusioned that he allows Evie to send the train on its way. Now, at the same time, because it is midnight, thousands of unarmed Londoners wearing Guy Fawkes masks march toward Parliament. The troops, who, remember, they're all just people, are asking their leadership, what do? We got these people coming toward us. You know, you gotta give the word if we're going to engage or not, and how we're going to engage. And the commander unseen is getting no word from the top officials, so he says, stand down, which, by the way, is the right thing to do.
It makes you wonder, though, in that situation, if that's really what would happen.
I would hope. See, that's the thing. That's the thing about movies is that you have hope in movies. I would hope that that's exactly what would happen. Because
yeah, I agree.
Now, is that happening on the streets of Ferguson, Missouri? No.
Boy.
But it would be nice if this were the ending that you got when you had unarmed people approaching armed people. Because Finch's suggestion of what was going to happen does not come true. They just walk past all of the military, which is a beautiful scene, by the way. And then Parliament House blows up. The whole thing, Houses of Parliament, Big Ben, all gone. And everybody takes off their mask. And in a beautiful moment, everybody who has died in this movie is in that crowd of people. And Hugo Weaving is in that crowd of people.
It's very metaphoric.
It's beautiful. It's great. You get to see everybody, including the little girl that gets killed, you know, including Gordon, including Valerie and Natasha, maybe?
Yeah. No, everybody was there.
Yeah. So let's be, in fact, I'm sure Evie's parents were there because, you know, of course, in the ending scene, when they asked who V was.
Who was he?
He was Edmund Dantes. And he was my father. And my mother. My brother. My friend. He was you. And me. He was all of us.
And then you're a little bit weepy. But then, of course, you have the 1812 overture and the explosions. And then everybody takes their mask off. So you're all like, and then Street Fighting Man starts. And you got the drums and the great guitar riff. And it's just great. Beautiful ending to a lovely movie.
And this is another one of those beautiful movies that we love because they're beautiful. Because it was beautifully shot and it was great.
Oh, yeah.
The visual, the special effects were great. I mean, this was shot in Berlin with lots of miniatures, by the way. It was shot in Studio Baselberg. So they used a lot of miniatures and they kind of moved some things around because some of the buildings aren't exactly where they really exist. And like on the O'Bailey, when they blew it up, they made the figure on top like way bigger just to kind of make it stand out when they blew it up. Of course, you know, just destruction's better when it's larger. But Hugo Weaving, his reach was just pretty awesome. I mean, I don't know how much of the stunt work he did, but his acting certainly was amazing. But if he did any of the stunt work on his own, you know, it was just mind-boggling.
Oh, just the acting alone is incredible. Just fantastic. And I guess there's no reason why he would have had to do his own stunts, but it's not like there was a lot that was, you think it would be beyond him.
Yeah, no, I like I said, I choose to believe he did all of it.
Yeah, well, that's okay. That's what we should do. Movies are the world of make-believe. They're all just make-em-ups. And so we can use them to enrich our real lives. God bless America, land that I love. Oh, sorry.
Wow.
Well, what else can you say about this movie? It's fantastic. And yeah, it's funny because, you know, it would be more like you'd want the 1812 overture to be behind your voice when you're giving the speech about movies enriching your real life, because a nationalistic music sort of goes against this whole the whole idea of this movie.
Well, and I think, so the ill-fated, I shouldn't say ill-fated, the now retired Rick Emerson radio program, which Barry and I are giant fans of and mourn the loss of, talked about when this movie came out, how, you know, they blow up Big Ben and they blow up Parliament and they blow up the Old Bailey, and that, you know, that's pretty amazing and impressive. But you really can't get away with that in America. Like, you could not. I mean, it's very hard to have a terrorist blow up the White House and get away with it. You know, there are a couple exceptions to that. Like, apparently aliens are just fine. Or Al-Qaeda in a movie sense, like White House down or whatever nationality they chose, you know, to, you know, some assault in the White House. But, you know, blowing up the entire seat of the government, not necessarily going to be a real popular movie in the United States.
Well, that's why it was so bold, because, it, like I said, it was hitting right at the right time. You know, it was 2005. It was the middle of the Bush administration.
Right.
We didn't know that the Obama administration wasn't going to be a whole hell of a lot better. We had hope, maybe. Anyway. Sorry, this is, should normally this would not be a political discussion. But, you know, when you're talking about, as far as I can see it, in America, you can, if you're a Democrat, you can think that the Republicans are all nationalists anyway. And if you're a Republican, you certainly believe that Democrats are socialists. But you combine those, and what do you have? It's the Nazi Party people, and we don't want any part of it. But then again, who would have thought that that we went from a country where gay marriage was outlawed in all but like two states, and now there's 30-something states, including my own state, where you can get married to anybody you want.
Boggling. I think I posted on Facebook, I really didn't envision the day that that was going to happen in Alaska.
Yeah, and you know what? It's a bloodless coup.
Yeah, and the government still stands.
Exactly. It doesn't really threaten anybody.
No.
Yeah, turns out freedom gives freedom to everyone.
Well, it goes back to that joke that you, that picture you see on Facebook, or I see on Facebook every now and then, that says, gay marriage doesn't threaten the sanctity of your third marriage.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. People like Jane Lynch has found out that gay divorce is also just as costly as regular divorce. Regular divorce. Then hetero divorce, whatever it would be called.
I don't know. I have mixed feelings. And, you know, my politics are complicated.
It turns out everybody's politics are complicated. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com. Or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.